Oak session number 1662H, reel 1.
Mr. Crubley, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in South Shields in County Durham. And on 24th of November 1922. 24th of October 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a marine engineer. On tugs initially and then deep sea.
Did you go to school on Tyneside?
No. I moved up to Orkney Islands, when I was 5, as my father had come ashore and got a job with a firm that was lifting the German battleships which had been scuttled there at the end of the 1418 war.
How old were you when you left school?
When finally?
Yes.
Oh, 17.
To do what?
Well, the war had started, so my ambition then was to fly. This wasn't taken too well by my parents because I was an only child. So my mother very kindly got a job for me in the post office because the post office was a reserved occupation. Unbeknown to her, of course, I had already volunteered for the Air Force on my 18th birthday. So that's when I joined the Air Force in 1940.
Was it easy to get in?
No, it was quite interesting because being so far away, I didn't have to come down to a selection board. The selection board came up to me. They were touring the country and they came to Orkney and called about 50 of us who had apparently volunteered for interviews, tests, aircraft recognition, anything that showed any interest in aircraft. Of that 50, there's about 3 civilians and all the rest were young soldiers who hoped to avoid going into the trenches. And we then, those of us who passed that, not only about 12 out of that lot, the rest were obviously just trying to get out, went down to Inverness, then straight down to Edinburgh, and I was enrolled. That was the first my mother knew about it, which was a bit upsetting for her.
I think you spent part of your training in Canada.
Yes.
How did that come about?
That, well, after the straightforward joining at Lord's Cricket Ground, ACRC, ITW, grading school, which was 9 hours in a tiger moth, I went on the Embraer training scheme to Canada, to Assiniboine in Saskatchewan for my basics, Tiger Moth, and then to Swift Current and on to Calgary because they just changed the stations. And I graduated in Calgary.
What was the quality of the training like there?
Very good, very good. We thoroughly enjoyed it. The local people were marvellous. What local people we could find in the wilds of the prairies of Saskatchewan, but it was a good time.
How long was the course for?
It should have been, to best my knowledge, about 6 months, but eight months. It turned about in nearer a year because a mishap in the amnesty, they had forgotten that it snowed in Canada, and when we got there in January, our airfield was still covered in about 6 foot of snow, so we were delayed. We did ground school twice before we managed to start flying, so it was all a little delayed. Then it went straight through from then. Graduated in November, I think.
So this was 42, was it?
This was 41. What did I put down? I can't honestly remember.
I think you've referred to the paper record from your logbooks and you'd like to correct the dates.
Yes, it was 1941. I started training, and it was 1942 I graduated at Calgary, got my wings in Calgary.
Was the Canadian Air Force much different from the RAF, as far as you could see?
Well, it wasn't. We were with RAF people. They manned it, they were the instructors. So we didn't really see. I think the station commander was a Canadian, but all the rest of the staff were British people. So we didn't really see the Canadians that time. But I can come on to that later because I went back to Canada.
Did you come across any elements in the population who were not in favour of the war or who showed any resistance?
We didn't experience any. We were warned of them when we landed. We landed in Moncton, caught a train, stopped in Quebec for only about an hour, and we were warned there not to go wandering around in, on our own, always have a little group, because feeling among the French Canadians was running a bit high at that time. Subsequently, many years afterwards, I did go to Quebec, and it was fine, but it was still very much France. But we had no trouble, no. Certainly not with the rest of the Canadians, who were very, very friendly, very good to us.
Was it suggested that the French Canadians might be Vichyite in their sentiments?
No, I don't think it was that. They were French, as opposed to being part of the British Empire, as it then was. And this has carried on, of course. They're still French.
How keen were you to get into an operational squadron?
I think like most of the youngsters of, at my time there, well, this was our aim in life. We were going to get operational as quickly as we could. And we used to get very frustrated by all the time delays, you know, waiting for the next period of our training, next part of our training to come along, with the fear that we would miss the war. It's a strange approach, but it's the fear we would miss the war.
What was the process of your getting onto an operational squadron?
Well, after Canada, we had to come back to UK and a series of courses, short ones. First, to give us some night flying in the country where there are no lights, because we've been used to night flying in all the blaze of lights in Canada. Then advanced flying unit, then an operational training unit on hurricanes. So all this took time, and it was a year before I eventually got on the squadron. Yes, August 43, before I eventually made squadron.
What squadron was this?
181 squadron. And Typhoons, which at that time was in Romney Marshes, on a wartime strip in Romney Marshes. It had, the squadron was a new squadron, formed, I believe, in March of that year. So it had no long history.
What kind of reception did you get on the squadron?
Oh, very good, very good. All very helpful. There were three of us arrived on the same day. We were all replacements, you know, for people who had been lost or tour expired. One of them had been tour expired, certainly. But they were all very good to us. This was the period, of course, when all the Typhoon squad and all those around the south coast were looking forward to the invasions, the 43 getting back into Europe. And all our time on 181 for until June was all along the south coast was preparations for looking forward to the invasion.
What kind of preparations were you making?
Attacking, our main role was attacking anything that moved, basically. The trains and any troop movements, anything like that we saw. And we were directed to various parts of northern France so that we wouldn't be apparently favouring one particular spot. So we dotted along, we went from Merston over to Chichester and then over to Bournemouth, Herne Airport as it is now, and were there when the invasion started.
Can you remember the first time you flew a Typhoon and what it felt like?
Felt a bit terrifying, to be honest, because it was the biggest aeroplane I'd flew. Having flown Hurricanes and this powerful beast. It had a bit of a reputation at that time. When we were asked at OTU what aircraft we wanted to go on, the majority of people said Spitfires, because that was the glamour machine of the time. Few of us said no, we would like Typhoons, because we had heard that there was a waiting list for Spitfires. And we had a week's leave. I had just got up to Orkney, actually, on my week's leave when I was recalled to join the squadron, Typhoon Squadron. And those of us who had opted for Typhoons were on the squadron 3 months before those who had asked for Spitfires. And in fact, two of them turned up eventually at Herne, at Herne Airport, having just got a Typhoon posting. They never did make Spitfires. The requirement was dying down there, you see. It was on the attack side rather than the fighter side. The requirement was mounting. So they didn't make Spitfires unless they went out to the Far East, which was the big requirement for Spitfires there. So we did better than the Spitboys in getting onto the squadron.
What were the main problems in flying the Typhoon specifically?
No problems. It was a big aeroplane, a heavy aeroplane for a fighter in those days. It terrified us on our first takeoffs by swinging like mad on takeoff, which you soon got used to, but it used to, which we didn't veer to starboard. Yes, it veered to starboard on takeoff, I think, or was it port? But anyway, it veered one way or the other, which was a bit of an eye-opener, but you soon got used to that. It was a heavy one. I had a lot of faith. It was a very robust aircraft, very robust aircraft. Could take an awful lot of punishment. And once we got used to it, it was fine.
Did you need muscle power to
be able to? No. No, you didn't need muscle power. But it was a heavy aircraft if you were doing any type of maneuvers. You know, it wasn't one of these like the Spitfire where you had a couple of fingers and she would go. It was solid. It was built for its purpose, ground attack.
And were there any accidents in the training?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, well, I suppose there's one or two, looking through the book, there were one or two spins, and it took an awful lot of height to get it out of a spin. So I suppose we lost one or two that way. But there were other causes which got more headlines, you know, shot down, and the aircraft had collected holes and things like that. Spinning was just one of those things you tried to avoid doing if you could, because you needed many thousands of feet to get the Typhoon out of a spin. It wasn't particularly manoeuvrable. It was hard work, as I said earlier, if you had to do any great manoeuvring.
What was the leadership of the squadron like at the time?
Very good. Squadron commander when I joined was Crowley Milling, who retired as Sir Dennis Air Marshal. Or is he a chief marshal? I'm not too sure now. Who lives not too far from this area. And he went over to another wing. That's right, he got promoted and went as a wing commander on 1-1 wing, I think it was. We were 1-4 wing. I can't remember what 6A. Squadron Jenkins or Keep. Squadron Keep. I'm not too sure who came first, because one of them was shot down and landed in the channel when we were in Merston. I think that was Jimmy Keep.
Do you remember your first operation?
Yes. My first operation was a very quiet one. It was escorting a convoy up the channel. And it was just a matter of flying out. We were practically on the channel from Romney Marshes. And we just flew up and down over these ships. Not a thing in sight. And just came back home. That was my first so-called operation. The first real operation was against Abbeville Airport, airfield. That was the first time we were shot at. But again, that was a bombing. We were using bombs at the time. And that was my first operational bombing trip, and my bombs wouldn't come away. So I had to come back carrying my two bombs. We got over the airfield, and I don't know who was leading the squadron that day, but I was instructed to stay airborne while the rest of the squadron landed. So that, quite logically, if they did go off, the airfield was, the rest of the squad was already on the ground, which has felt a bit of a lonely spot for me while I was going around and around. But they didn't come off, so all was well.
Was there any opposition to that raid?
Apart from anti-aircraft, no. We didn't often see fighter aircraft. Once or twice we saw 109s, but I can only recall being attacked two or three times, and we didn't suffer any damage. We can usually outrun them, and we were usually on our way home, coming, you know, having left the coast, so they didn't pursue us. So we never really troubled by enemy aircraft. I wasn't personally, one or two, dependent. Flak was our big danger, rather than any aircraft. The 190s, they came over while we were in Normandy. We got the odd ground attack from them, but only once or twice did that happen.
What was the method of dealing with Flak?
Just changing height, changing direction, just a quick violent turn, and they hope you're upset their tracking. Our big thing was to avoid getting too near to the ground when you're crossing the border, the coastline. We used to fly over at as low a level as we could, sea level, until you were about what? Couple of miles, I suppose, from the coast, and then climb like mad. The aim was to get above 8,000 feet, if I recall the height, because that was about the best height for the aircraft guns they had. And then let down over the other side to do our ground attack, searching or attacking. But flak was our big danger, because the 88 mil gun was a very accurate gun. And I know I had a few holes at various times, but touch wood, I was never shot down. But quite a few, we lost quite a few.
And then after the attack on Abbeville Airfield, what operation do you remember after that?
Not very many. From New Romney we went over to Merston. Now we did a few more. Merston, Chichester area, wartime field just beside Tangmere. We did a few more sorties, rhubarbs over France, just wandering around looking for trains, looking for anything that moved, interdiction raids. And then over to Herne, which was obviously, although we weren't aware of it at the time, the build-up towards the invasion.
What exactly is a rhubarb operation?
A rhubarb was, just as I said, you go away in your territory and go wander around looking for things, and not a specific target, in other words. This was usually okay, because we were a bit too far away to react, I suppose. If anyone spotted anything large moving by the time we got airborne and got over there, we'd probably be away. So we got reports there's a lot of activity in a particular area, and we would go over and have a look. By this time, we were using rockets as opposed to bombs.
How did you prefer the two? Which did you prefer?
Rockets, definitely.
Why was that?
Accuracy. It did mean we had to fly lower, of course, but they were good. Bombs, you tended to drop, and you didn't really have that much control over them.
What did it feel like when you fired the rockets? Could you feel them leaving the plane?
No. You could feel the bombs going off, because the weight, you know, you were dropping initially 2 500s and later on 2 1,000-pound bombs, so you could feel the weight of those leaving you. But the rockets, no, they self-propelled, so you didn't feel them. You saw them going, of course, but you didn't feel them. that with four rockets you could select pairs, and they were very good against the sort of targets we were after, trains, tanks, anything like that. The rockets were the thing for accuracy. And they were good. They were a very good weapon, I think.
Did they have any drawbacks to use?
No, they... I suppose you could say the height we had to get down. We used to... This is memory. I think we used to cruise around about 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and if we saw anything, get dive from about 3,000 feet. And I suppose we pulled up about 1,000 and climbed like mad. So you were getting a bit close to the ground with light anti-aircraft fire. So from that point of view, we did lose quite a few people in the early days, because when we first went into rockets, we were advised by the Hurricane Force, who had used rockets in North Africa first, get down to, now they said, cruise along at about 3,000 feet. Start your dive from about 3,000 feet. But they had been using them in the desert, of course. There was no great ground obstacles. So we tried it, and if I recall, our first major operation was from... where was it? Yes, from Merston against a factory in Kong, and I wasn't actually on it, but I know we lost of the six went over or eight went over. We lost four of them. They came down, three of them came down, then one came down over the target, and the other three landed in the channel. They were picked up, so they were all right, but it was an expensive raid from that point of view. We lost the aircraft, and we had to relook our technique. And we then started diving from 5,000 or 6,000 feet in a steeper dive, more 45-degree dive as opposed to the Hurricane's 30-degree dive. And our losses, of course, went down. Our speed went up and our losses went down. But it was a marvelous weapon, the rocket. I liked the rocket.
So it's beginning to be almost like dive bombing.
Yes, it was a fairly steep dive. Not like bomb. A bomb, you had to get 60-70 degree dive to really get a bomb going out. But the rocket had some self-propulsion, so it we ended up being very, we did a little practice firing them, but it took a little time to get the hang of them, because they were a bit of a mixture between the bomb and a gun in their gravity drop. But they became very accurate. We became very accurate with them.
What's the first operation you remember in which you felt it was a real success that you were involved in?
We came across in one of our rhubarbs, this must have been 43, 44, beginning of 44, and we came across two tanks. So we attacked them, and we hit them, and they vanished. It was the most successful in attack, which confirmed our faith in the rocket. If you were accurate, it really was. It carried a 60-pound warhead, so it was a lot of armor to armament to land on a tank. On that, later on, see, when we get to Normandy days, there were targets all over the place, and they really did a lot of damage to our enemies.
Did you actually operate on D-Day itself?
Yes. One of my memories has been over the beachhead at 20 minutes past 7 o'clock, and the first troops went in at 7, I think. We were overhead 20 minutes after they landed. We were day fighters, so we didn't operate at night with the rockets, which was... It was quite a sight, as you can imagine. I'm sure you've heard, going across the channel with all that shipping. I don't recall us ever having to attack anything. We were over there on call. If the army had particular spots they wanted to attack him, we attacked. I can't remember, actually, that we did any. We just were overhead as long as our fuel were low, and then went back home again. But I suspect we probably had to get rid of our rockets somewhere before we went. And that was our tactic then for quite a few days, quite a few weeks, until they got an airfield built for us on the other side. The first one was about 6 weeks. No, less than 3 weeks after D-Day. They had bulldozers stripped out, and we landed over there for the first time. But that was just for refueling, rearming, and off again, and back to UK overnight, because the strip was still under, within the range of the German howitzers.
Did the strip have a name or number?
It was B2. What its name was, I don't honestly know.
What other operations stick out in your mind from Normandy in particular that you took part in?
There were two more. It's rather vague because we were doing four trips a day in Normandy, because we were right there. Our sortie time was probably about 20 minutes only. We were up and down because the target was just more or less across the fields. And I can remember one in which I found to my horror when I came down that I was full of holes, and I was terribly lucky because the AGAC had missed a fairly vital pipes and things by, you know, fractions. Another one in which I hopefully took off with the squadron, but the engine cut out. And this was the beginning of the dust problem we had in Normandy when we first got there. Tremendous amount of dust. And in fact, we had to evacuate for a short time, 6 days or so. We had to go back to UK because we had these big inlets and the dust was getting into the aircraft, into the engine, and they had to produce a filter. So we had a large filter installed in the air intake, which was quite hairy because I ran off the end of the runway, and my wheels went into a trench, and she did like that, and I had 8 armed rockets, but nothing happened.
The aircraft stood on its nose.
It stood on its nose, yes. When the wheels went into this farmer's trench, you see. But nothing happened. But I can remember that operation, which didn't happen. But generally, no, it was just up and down and up and down. So we're sitting at the end of the runway, because we did, what was it called? Cab ranks. Usually four aircraft. We're up on patrol all the time. On call for the army, and if they got held up by anything, we would put smoke down and we'd go down and attack that. Having fired your rockets, you went back home and the next lot took off. So there's in the early days there were 4 aircraft sitting on the end of the runway all the time, soon daylight hours, waiting for that. So it was all a blur. It was all happening so quickly there. And yet, looking back on my logbook now, we were there for a relatively short time before the army broke out. And we ended up pursuing them. They were going faster than we could find airfields.
What about the Falaise Gap?
Falaise Gap, yes. I missed the best. I'm saying the best part is probably not the kindest thing, but it was an exciting time. I happened to be on leave when it started, so I got back towards the end of it. But I gather it was very hectic in the early days because there were so many tanks there. There were more tanks than aeroplanes, and it was slaughter from the Germans' point of view. They were helpless. They'd been, you know, trapped, enclosed into this bocage.
So you were in the latter part of the Falaise Gap.
In the latter part of it, yes. Yeah. And been going on for 2 or 3 days before I came back.